Hello, friends. My name is Virgil Cantrip, and I'm about to take you on a journey. A journey to a place both familiar and distant, both dangerous and welcoming. A land of wasted dreams and of opportunity. A land that I call the United States of Apocalypsia. Together, we are going to meet some fascinating characters, surviving and thriving out there in the waste. Perhaps with their stories, and a little help from my trusted Atlas Almanac, we can piece together a story of what happened here, what is happening, and, most importantly, what happens next. I awoke to the sound of gulls cawing and a far-off tune being carried by the wind. Somewhere nearby, cheerful trumpeting reverberates off of buildings and water, coming louder and closer. I open my eyes to the glow of a warm mid-afternoon sun basking over me. The water around me ebbs with the tide, but my world is steady. I look down at my feet. What's this? I appear to be lying on some sort of dock, but where are Sharon and the Mississippi Queen? What happened? And more importantly, where am I? Suddenly, louder and clearer, footsteps, trumpeting. Footsteps and trumpeting. A sudden stop to the music, followed by a deep inhale. And a welcome to the city of old New Orleans. Followed by a question of what brings me to the city on water. Hello, friend. My name is Virgil Cantrip, and I just arrived here on a boat. Or I think I did. That's the last thing I can recall. My new friend introduces himself as Kane. He is a local jazz musician, with soulful brown eyes, long dreadlocks resting under his tapered black hat. And finally, with some bearings, I take a good look around at my surroundings, soaking in the city. There she was, old New Orleans, caked in the radiant glow of a June mid-afternoon. The water around me murky, but no longer an impenetrable void, flowed back and forth slowly in the canal currents between partially submerged buildings. There is no street or ground level. Rather, it is now made up of balconies and the once upper floors of old buildings. Bridges between the rooftops and balconies connect by planks, debris, and human ingenuity. Kane stops me for a second, asks me why I'm talking to myself. Ha, good one, Kane. I'm talking to you, my friends and fellow wanderers in the wasteland. Kane, my new friend. Please, tell me about your city and its denizens, so I may share its stories with them. And this time I motion towards the headset and microphone piece to reaffirm that I am not just talking to myself. Kane tells me a brief but all-encompassing story of a collapse, not only of dams and buildings, but of order, of society. When a city that suffered greatly, drowned by floods and storms, was cast out and left behind. When the city was in its most dire state, its hour of need, the world outside turned its back. The city had been used to ill treatment and half-measured help from the mainland before, but the situation had never been this bad. As it turned out, the situation in old New Orleans was not isolated, but rather part of the great collapse. This is not the first time old New Orleans was left behind by the mainland, but it would certainly be the last time they asked for help. It was the last time there was anyone outside who could help. Here, in New Orleans, years of rising tides had taken their toll. The pressure of the water broke the dams and levees, holding it back, and surged the great Pontchartrain Lake, turning it into a sea, and then combining it with the greater Gulf. In a matter of days, the ground in all but the highest sections of the city became the new seabed as the rising waters advanced upon the districts of the city below ever-elevating sea level. And the water coming in was so polluted, it was toxic. The city became a chain of islands, some arranged in neat grids like the streets below, and some on far-off hills and fallen towers. Incredible. Kane, I had suspected this happened to much of the world's cities, but to hear it firsthand, so many of them have been abandoned. So few people even know what happened to tell me and the other inquiring minds of the wastes. How do you know so much about what happened? Cain tells me that in old New Orleans, everyone is taught to never forget what happened, and to keep their old traditions alive. It is not like that everywhere, he asks me. No, my friend, it is not. Some places hold stores of ancient knowledges, but most have fallen far further than old New Orleans. He in turn asks me, how do I know that? I have read and read again the Atlas Almanac, my wealth of knowledge and reference in this dangerous and exciting world. And I have traveled to see for myself and share this knowledge with others. Cain, what else can you tell me? There is more, he says, but he knows someone who will tell the story better, since she was there. He was already on his way to meet her, he says, and that she'd love to talk to someone from beyond the islands. Cain guides me down a series of narrow streets and bridges flanking both sides of the canal. Brightly lit neon signs flash ahead, casting down a reflection of light in the water. He leads me to a shop house at the edge of one of these streets, its gleaming marquee lights bouncing off the water, even in the bright of a sunny afternoon, displaying prominently the name Blackwood Hills Voodoo Shop. We enter via the second floor balcony door, which has become the main entrance since the lower level is entirely submerged. As we enter, we are immediately overtaken by the scents of sandalwood and lavender permeating throughout the shop. The shadows of dancing candle flames cajole about the walls and floors. Names like Witch's Wildwood, Nightshade, and Yankee are etched onto paper tags, solely for the neon light glowing through the many rose and turquoise-colored windows. There doesn't appear to be powered lights inside the shop. Painstakingly decorated wooden bookcases run along the walls, adorned with tomes on the occult, guides for contacting the dead, ritual handbooks, and cookbooks. Elsewhere in the store, large round tables display herbs, spices, and home remedy books, as well as other volumes on the practical, magical, and culinary arts. Sage leaves, rosemary sprigs, and garlic cloves are all present across the tabletop. And behind a tall counter, with an old cash box on top, stood a short, stout, older woman with curly white hair and chestnut eyes, hiding behind thick bifocals, displaying a broad smile very similar to that of my jazz-playing companion. She waved welcome and greeted her great-grandson. In turn, Cain introduced me to his great-grandmother Ella, who runs the shop. She explains to me that she sells healing herbs and spices, mostly, and acts more like an apothecary than a kitschy voodoo shop. Some of the herbs are used for poor man's medicine, as she calls it, but mostly for cooking, which at the least, she says, heals the soul. I tell her that to have herbs and seasoning such as this today is a rare thing indeed, as the farms of old days have all gone sallow, and the farmers today scrape by on subsistence of what they can grow. I ask her where she came to possess such an invaluable assortment of foods. She tells me the city grows them on rooftops and in buildings that were farms in the city before it all fell, and that they still grow using the power of the sun and old world technology. I also ask Ella about the voodoo of the shop. It fascinates me, and I am not familiar with it through my travels or my almanac. It appears to be some sort of old religion, maybe more of like a folklore, but I'm not quite sure. Ella tells me that she was never much of a believer, but she took refuge here in a family friend's shop so many years ago, and that they are long gone, given back to the sea. And since then, this has been her home for nearly a century. She stands before me, very, very old by Apocalypsia standards, at 112 years old. In her advanced years, she must have grown up in the time before the world turned upside down, having lived here her whole life. Cain gathers some chairs for us to sit around a table as Ella begins her story. Ella was born in the city of New Orleans in 2020. Back then, levies had kept back the Pontchartrain. Back when the not-so-ancient society and governments ruled across the lands and ruins and settlements that were once known as cities and towns. Back then, New Orleans was a city and part of the state of Louisiana and part of the United States of America. These lands now have no name or unified government. Each territory stretches out independently, and not always peacefully with their neighbors. Old New Orleans has been spared most of that, as the floodwaters and frequent storms have kept most outsiders away. The city, having been through so many years of strife, has rebuilt itself, unified under a single leader. I ask her what happened in the early days. Ella says she was still young when the Great Collapse, as it is called, happened. The resource wars came far faster and more devastating than any of the leaders in her time could have predicted or prepared for. In New Orleans, the city government did not last much longer than the federal. When things fell apart, resources got even more scarce. Law and order began to leave the city in droves, and only those too poor or stubborn to leave remained. There was a long period of violence. Gangs had turned to raiding, attacking their fellow survivors. After decades of wars and destruction, the raiders unified under one leader, an eccentric Cajun, who adorned himself with the title of the monarch King Louis I. King Louis had accumulated so much wealth and power in his time as a raider chieftain that he became the most powerful force in the city. He was brutally efficient when it came to cleaning up the city and ridding himself of the competition. When someone opposed him, he made sure there would be no survivors. He killed all of the other raider gangs? I ask Ella for clarification. Yes, Ella tells me. There were those who opposed the new king, especially in the other gangs of raiders. But during the period of great cleansing, as the chroniclers call it, he gave all the gang leaders two options: join him or perish. He united all of the leaders who would join him, and he destroyed all who opposed him. In monopolizing violence, he returned law and order to the city, which he had officially renamed Old New Orleans. He built a code, similar to the laws before the Great Collapse, and for the first time in 40 years, there was a peace in the streets. Louis was a warlord, and a brutal one, but it turned out to be an effective administrator. The people of the city stopped fighting each other long enough to start rebuilding. How did he rebuild the city? Ella tells me from the old gangs he gathered together. He established the Knights of St. Louis, turned them into a police force, and based them in the city cathedral. With the old gang leaders, they established the council. They built a flotilla, bringing back safe travel with longboats and floated carriages called trolleys. After that, floating farms, bridges, solar panels began to feed and power parts of the city. The king even reopened schools in parts of the city with old survivors teaching lessons from the past. Kane adds in that Ella spent a lot of time as one of such learned elders. For a city built on the backs of pirates and raiders was surprisingly peaceful and prosperous. Maybe they had gotten tired of fighting and found that if everyone did better, so would they, Ella says. And it's not like the robbing ended. It's just called taxes now. But with it comes protection, stability, and infrastructure. Three things that never did before. She then talked about the new classes of survivors that emerged in King Louis' society. At the top, there's the king and the counselors, and then the knights. Underneath them are the merchants and artisans. Kane and Ella are of the artisan merchant class, where musicians and chefs hold a higher status in the city. Below the merchant class are the farmers and the fishermen. Kane tells Ella not to forget about the divers. But wait, who are the divers? I ask to both of them. Ella looks out across the table, past me and Kane, through the open French doors of the balcony to the canal streets, the neon lights flashing ever brighter as the afternoon sky gives way to dusk. Music starts playing from far off, and I imagine it can be heard throughout the city as it echoes off the buildings and water. Her attention trails back to the divers as she looks sorrowfully at the water. They are the lowest caste in the hierarchy of Old New Orleans. They spend their lives diving to the underwater ruins of the city. Sickness and short lifespans are all too common because of their prolonged exposure to the poisons under the water. Actual diving gear is rare, and only the best of the divers have such gear. Those who have it wear it proudly like a suit of armor and are treated better. That's only for the divers who find artifacts of real value, though. Batteries, tools, jewels, undamaged electronics. The rest of them jump in unprotected eyes burning, using hoses for air and lacking any protections against the rusty beasts below. Who runs the city now, Ella? King Louis III, she says. The successive generations of successful kings has brought a kinder hand to the throne, though no less sharp a mind. Now the king shares power with the city council, and the councillors are chosen from high-ranking members of the other castes. As of recent years, now even a diver sits on the council. From outside the shop, the music grows louder and louder. The lights shine brighter as the sun kisses the horizon. King gets up and begins to collect some of his things, including his trumpet. He hands me a necklace of green plastic beads and says the festival is starting soon, Virgil. You are welcome to join us. Ooh, a festival. How exciting, friends. And he says there's a parade as well. Well, what is the occasion? Kane tells me the last king, King Louis II, started this parade as a way to celebrate his father's legacy of having founded the new city. Near the start of every summer, the parade is hosted to celebrate and make an offering for a light storm season. A parade of boats called floats are dressed up and decorated with fanciful purples and greens as it makes its way through town. Upon their decks, musicians play and food is handed out to the people. The festival starts tonight, and Kane has welcomed me to join him and his band, the Neptunes, on their boat. What luck! Lucky me. Lucky us, friends. We not only get to observe the local festivities, but we are privy to partake in the ongoing celebrations. Remembering what Kane said about the storm season, I ask, it is starting soon? Truthfully, it is a year-round occurrence, Kane replies. Summer is just the worst of it. Sometimes, storms strike even before the festival begins. During the long summer, storms often hit the city multiple times a month. Ella says the storms are common during season, as common as the rain once was. She was born during one of such storms, as was Kane. The storms are part of the cycle of life here. They come bringing birth and death. And the people have adapted, as they always will, she says, putting the matter to rest. From up the canal, the music playing becomes louder as a float drifts closer towards the shop. The barge docks right in front, and a group of musicians smile and greet Kane and Ella cheerily. Kane introduces me to his band, the Neptunes, and says they are a motley crew of musicians in the city who joined together as kids when Ella would let them play on the Blackwood shop rooftop. Harry sits at an old piano somehow welded onto this boat. Wilbur plays a trombone, and Neville sings and wails on an old snare drum. When I ask about the float, Harry tells me that it's their usual venue, convenient for taking gigs anywhere in the city, but decorated with a bit more flair than usual. Kane and Ella guide me aboard. On the bow of this boat is a large painted wooden statue of a man with a great white beard and flowing hair. He wears a crown of shells and plays a trumpet in one hand and carries a trident in the other. I've not seen such a figure as this but in some pictures, and I ask about him to the band. Harry and Wilbur give me a look and ask, "You've never heard about Neptune?" asking what did I think the band's name meant. Kane walks up after loading the last of the equipment on board and pats me on the back, reminding his bandmates that I am not from Old New Orleans, and that I am here to learn and share what's good with the world. Neville laughs back and proclaims, "Here's what you need to know. Louis is king, Neptune is god, music is life, and food is bigger than all of them." And his bandmates and Ella break out together in laughter. I assist Ella with pushing the boat forward through the canals, though I use assist lightly. Ella skillfully does most of the work. It's my first time handling oars, and my second boat ride. Not bad, friends. But also not as simple as the Almanac's nautical section may have led me to believe. Our float drifts closer to the city. We join the growing flotilla in the open space over the old Jackson Square Plaza, to its north end standing the ruins of the St. Louis Cathedral, home of the Knights. Every passing moment, more fantastically decorated ships enter the plaza. All manner of lanterns and figureheads adorn the ships, including carved reliefs of giant beasts, peacocks, crocodiles, and lobsters, oh my! Some of these animal figures I do not recognize from the Almanac's bestiary, and must inquire about later. On board the floats, men and women alike dance around, infested suits and dresses patterned in fantastical greens and purples. Many of our fellow boaters are musicians. Some appear to be merchants and others knights of the city. All around me are the sounds of music traveling on the wind, the reflections of lanterns and figures dancing across the water. I've seen few scenes as happy as this in my travels across Apocalypsia. I hold on to the rare moment dearly. And now, entering from the south, a large wooden ship far grander than the rest, and like none I've ever seen but in pictures of old galleons from the past, appears on the scene. It has multiple levels, and large red sails hung on thick masts. All of the other boats begin to light the last of their torches. The crackling fires from their lanterns dance in the water's reflection, as the music lowers and ceases. In the brief silence, Kane tells me that this boat is King Louis III's flagship, the Bourbon. He says the city chroniclers claim that this ship is a 500-year-old warship from the French Empire that founded the city. Ella laughs and tells me it is an old booze cruise party ship she recognizes from her childhood. She doesn't keep that information much of a secret, but says the king's efforts at a legacy are sometimes more important than accuracy. When it seems that there are no more torches to light and no more room for floats, King Louis III steps out. From our spot, we see the King of Old New Orleans clear and well lit in the lantern glow. He stands an imposing tower of a man, with a large black beard and flowing locks of raven hair. Brandishing a bright red cape, red mask, and gold crown, he appears the portrait of a monarch, like in the old history books. He steps out onto the ship's deck, and he lights a lantern that had been placed on an altar on his ship. He holds it up and releases it into the air. What a magnificent sight! As he finishes, the music begins playing even louder, and Kane and the Neptunes play louder than ever. The festival has officially begun!